Good morning, everyone. I want to say, this is Matthew Johnson from USAID. I want to welcome you to our first ever Ask the Procurement Executive teleconference. We're excited today. We've got, I think we had around 470 people RSVP to participate on the call, so we're very excited by the turnout. Really, the purpose of this call is to try and go beyond the business forecast and answer more in-depth substantive questions that I know many of you have about the work that we do at USAID. You know, we've been had an amazing turnout with some of our business forecast phone calls, and we realize that folks have questions sort of outside the business forecast. So for this very first call, just so you know where the questions came from, we polled five of our associations, Interaction, Inside NGO, the Council of International Development Companies, the Small Business Association of International Development Companies, and the Society for International Development. So we asked each of the associations to submit to us sort of their top three questions for their members. So we have compiled some of the questions. We've taken some of the questions that you sent us on Twitter, and we have around 16 questions total that we're going to go through over the next hour with you guys. I want to make some quick introductions. We've got a number of folks in the room with us today, but I want to introduce the main folks that will be speaking to us today. So obviously we have Aman Jabahani, our Senior Procurement Executive, here with us today. We've got Mauricio Vera, who's the Director of our Office of Small Disadvantaged Business Utilization. We've got Diane Peroni, who's our Acting Acquisition and Assistance Ombudsman, and Bruce McFarland, who's the Chief of Operational Innovations for USAID's Global Development Lab. And my name's Matt Johnson. I'm the Communications Director for the Office of Acquisition and Assistance. So I want to give just a couple of brief instructions before we get going. We will be recording this call, and we'll be sending out a recording of the call as well as detailed notes of the call. Probably hopefully later today or early tomorrow morning once we're able to get everything finalized. We ask that you not put us on hold during this call. I have muted all the participants, but sometimes when folks put us on hold, we get to hear nice background music, so we ask that you do not put us on hold. So with that, I want to turn it over to Aman just to give a couple of just introductory remarks before we dive into the questions that have been submitted to us.
Great, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you for sending us your questions. In the acquisition assistance world, there are so many moving parts. There are new policies and procedures that we are all working to implement on a regular basis. In addition, at USAID, we've been focusing on improving how we do business. I realize that in the result of the changes and new policies and procedures, many questions arise. Some of your questions are very easy to answer, but many of them are not. They require a lot of thought and discussion. As partners, we do not have many forums or opportunities to discuss questions and issues we're all facing. As we indicated on the invite for this call, we are planning on making this call a quarterly event. I hope that during our call today and in subsequent calls, we answer the many questions and concerns you have. Once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Aman. I want to dive straight into the questions. I also want you guys to know a lot of folks, partner associations, sent somewhat similar questions, so we tried to combine some of the questions together. And I want to say probably the top question we received was related to choice of instrument. So Aman, I want to ask you, many partners have expressed concern over the seemingly blurred lines between how USAID uses acquisition and how we use assistance. Can you share the factors that influence the decision to use a certain mechanism over another? Can you share what steps we're taking to clear up any confusion around acquisition versus assistance?
Yes, Matt, thank you. I understand that it is very important, that it's a very important issue for all of you. As I understand, many associations submitted a question related to this topic. I want you to know that this is a very important issue to me as well. Typically, USAID's assistance instruments account for 65 to 70% of all awards, and acquisition instrument account for 30 to 35% of our awards. It is important to note that USAID has no preference for one mechanism over the other. ADS 304 states this long-standing agency policy. Contracting officers and our agreement officers must determine the appropriate instrument for each award in accordance with the principal purpose of the award. ADS 304 also identifies the factors set forth in the Federal Grants and Cooperative Agreements Act for determining choice of instrument. As you are likely aware, there have been recent case law developments concerning the U.S. government's choice of instrument. The recent cases reinforce that the principal purpose of the relationship between USAID and the recipient organization is paramount in determining the appropriate choice of instrument. If the principal purpose is the acquisition of property or services for the direct benefit of USAID, then we must use a contract. If the principal purpose of the relationship is to benefit an eligible recipient by transferring something of value to the recipient, then we must use assistance. As decisions on these cases have been handed down, I have used them as an opportunity to remind staff about the importance of selecting the appropriate type of mechanism. In addition, I have reminded COs that concerns about procurement action lead time, as we all know it, PALT, bid protest remedies, type of implementing organization, effect on USAID resources, and desired operational control or programmatic involvement are not criteria for determining the choice of instrument. Later this year, we'll be updating our choice of instrument guidance for USAID staff. If you would like to provide input or insight into choice of instrument matters or on this guidance once it is published, please feel free to email us at ombudsman@usaid.gov to share your thoughts. Finally, let me share that as a result of the case law developments, we have seen increased interest in the business community regarding USAID's choice of instrument generally and also in the context of specific actions. In instances where the agency's choice of instrument has been questioned by the business community or instances where the mission has requested assistance and input on choice of instrument, the Ombudsman Office has been taking the lead in reviewing questions, comments, and concerns. This type of review is certainly a heavy lift. We spend a considerable amount of time reaching out to missions to discuss choice of instrument. We review choice of instrument determinations memoranda and draft or posted solicitations in the instances where the activity has progressed to the point where these documents exist. Our interest is in getting choice of instrument right, not in recommending that a mission uses one type of instrument over another. I would also like to mention that based upon our experience thus far, we can be the most helpful to partners and to the field when there is an active solicitation or a draft solicitation that is available for review, because then we are looking at something that is tangible. There have been a number of instances in recent months where when we were asked to review a change in instrument type identified on the business forecast. While we welcome the early notice, please understand that we are limited in how we can assist the partner and the mission when the mission is in the process of reassessing their program and preparing or revising their solicitation. We are likewise limited in the options and advice we can raise with the mission when a partner raises a choice of instrument concern shortly before the solicitation is about to close. The most productive dialogues have occurred when a partner raises specific concerns about a specific draft solicitation or live solicitation.
Thank you, Aman. I want to kind of follow up to that question. It's somewhat related to that. Many partners have expressed concerns that USAID agreement officers and agreement officer representatives, AOs and AORs, after an award has been made, treat recipients of cooperative agreements like contractors. Can you share what USAID is doing to ensure that staff understand the difference between a cooperative agreement and a contract post-award?
Sure, Matt. ADS 303 provides guidance on the elements of substantial involvement in four areas. Approval of a recipient's implementation plan, approval of specified key personnel, agency collaboration and involvement on specified elements of the PD, and the authority to immediately halt construction activity. As a preliminary matter, if a notice of funding opportunity or NOFO, as I'm going to call it throughout today, envisions more extensive substantial involvement. Bring it to the attention. Yeah, so basically, if a NOFO envisions more extensive substantial involvement, bring it to the attention of the AO and or the ombudsman. NOFOs should not be providing substantial involvement beyond the elements in ADS 303. Moreover, additional requirements could be an indication that the wrong choice of instrument was selected. Both our MOAA staff and our AORs have received formal training on the elements of substantial involvement. If requirements are being specified after award and is inconsistent with the award, I urge you to explain your concerns to the person making a request that you believe is inappropriate. If this does not work, your next steps will depend upon who has issued a request that is inconsistent with the award. If the request is coming from the AOR, you may want to raise it with the AO. If the request is coming from the AOR with AO concurrence, you may want to raise the situation with the ombudsman. The acting ombudsman informs me that if the requirement appears in the NOFO, she can generally address the partner's concern anonymously. If the request appears after award and is a matter of award administration, however, she advises that it is almost always necessary for her to ask the partner to waive confidentiality so she can communicate with the AO and understand both sides of the issue. This is the type of situation that we can best address when there is an actual situation we can examine, rather than a hypothetical question. I urge you not to stay silent.
Thank you, Aman. I want to kind of switch gears a little bit for the next question, our third question. I know it's something that you like to talk about. What are some of the bottlenecks that hamper a rapid and timely decision of making an award, and what has been done to streamline the process and overcome some of the barriers around making awards in a timely fashion?
For those of you that have heard me speak, you know that reducing the amount of time it takes to make an award is my number one priority. We call this PALT, or Procurement Action Lead Time. For a world that is rapidly changing, we must be able to make awards more quickly and efficiently. I know there are financial implications for your organizations as you wait for award to be made. In 2009, for contracts over $25 million, it took USAID an average of 513 days to make an award, and that is simply unacceptable. This year, we've begun instituting a number of changes and best practices to better manage PALT. This includes creating and using more acquisition and assistance templates, sequestering technical evaluation panels, and reducing the complexity and number of evaluation criteria. We also have monthly milestone report requirements for all of our major awards. As we have begun to implement these changes, I'm pleased to say that we are seeing a major reduction in PALT. Through the third quarter of this fiscal year, we have seen a 20% reduction in PALT times for Washington. We have a goal of 40% reduction in PALT by 2017, and I believe we're on our way to reaching that goal. In acquisition, we are streamlining the process by developing standard templates for each stage of the procurement process. The templates have streamlined the process, reduced disparate practice among COs, and have improved the quality of our source selections. On the assistance side, in our efforts to reduce PALT, we stood up an assistance streamlining working group. Through the group, and with the release of the new 2CFR 200, we've made several changes on how we execute assistance instruments. This includes creating more standard templates, limiting evaluation criteria from 3 to 1. We now only review for technical merit, eliminating competitive ranges, performing cost reviews of only apparently successful applicants, using standard preliminary 10% negotiated indirect cost rate agreement, or NICRA, for new partners. And finally, eliminating caps on fixed amount awards, formerly called FOGs. We have also made a few changes post-award. We have removed the requirement for prior written approval of foreign travel, And we have also stated there is no approval necessary for budget changes if the change is less than 10% of the total budget. Of course, approvals are necessary for construction activities. Not all events that can potentially impact the procurement can be streamlined away. Bid protests. If there is a pre-award protest and a seeker stay, we cannot make the award until the protest is resolved. Corrective action. It is always within the CO's discretion to take action to correct an error in the evaluation process. Rotation of contracting officers and others to new posts. Statutorily mandated home leave for Foreign Service officers. Matt, that's it for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Aman. I think it's great that that being sort of a top priority, I feel like there's a lot that's happened over the last year, and I think one of the things since we started instituting these changes this year, I think what we'll see is that as procurements happen moving forward, we'll start to see a much shorter times and what it takes to actually make awards, which I think is great. Next question is related to the ADS, and I think USAID staff understanding of the ADS. I want to read this question that was sent in to us. It says, one of the associations expressed concern that USAID staff cite ADS provisions as if they were binding contract or grant requirements. Is this appropriate, and do the ADS provisions have effective dates? And then sort of the last part of that question, does USAID plan to include an ADS archive on its internet website?
Sure. Thanks, Matt. This is a very difficult question to answer in the abstract. Let me explain why. The ADS contains the organization and functions of USAID, along with the policies and procedures that guide the agency's programs and operations. Agency employees must adhere to ADS policy directives and procedures. You are technically correct that ADS applies to agency employees and not to contractors and grantees. However, ADS incorporates requirements that are applicable to contractors and grantees because the requirement is mandated elsewhere. An example of this would be branding and marketing. A CO or AO may cite to the ADS rather than the CFR or to the contract or grant itself simply because the ADS is the citation he or she is most familiar with. In the event that the CO AO cites to the ADS, an approach might be to ask him or her where the requirement is incorporated into the award. If you believe the COAO is imposing requirements that are inconsistent with the terms of your award, you can also reach out to the ombudsman. Also note that each section of the ADS shows the effective date. Information in ADS is continuously updated to align USAID policies with the latest statutes, regulations, administrative policy statements, and other guidance. I am not aware of any initiative underway to keep archived version of ADS on the website. The Ombudsman has posed the question to the ADS team, and there is an update, and as soon as there's an update, we will let you know.
Thank you, Aman. I want to kind of stick to the question. Another question kind of related to USAID staff. One of the associations said there's been several instances over the last few months where missions have provided responses to questions posed by offerors or applicants with only a few days remaining before the solicitation deadline. And obviously we know that creates a burden on them of trying to respond back to the questions or trying to get the questions that they've answered and incorporate them into their proposals. What can be done to encourage missions to respond to questions sooner?
Matt, it's interesting that this is being raised today, actually. I send a weekly note out to our acquisition assistant staff around the world, around 800 people total. In my last two weekly notes, I discussed the subject of exchanges with industry before receipt of proposals. 2 weeks ago, I encouraged the use of pre-solicitation and pre-proposal conferences, often called industry days at USAID, as a best practice that is allowable under FAR 15.201, of which we don't always take advantage. Last week, I focused on the use of written Q&A exchanges that we conduct frequently before solicitation close. In my note, I encourage COs to respond to questions as quickly as possible before the closing date for receipt of proposals. In instances where the CO knows that the Q&A will not be posted sufficiently ahead of the proposal submission date, I encourage them to consider extending the deadline sooner. I think this practice will allow our partners to maximize use of resources and submit higher quality proposals. Finally, I've spoken with my team here in Washington, building off of the OMB Mythbusters memo and guidance that I've seen other federal agencies disseminate. My office will be putting together a best practice guide for COs and AOs on how to engage with industry. We will certainly include information about responding back to inquiries in a timely fashion.
Thank you, Amana. Kind of sticking with the staffing theme again, another question that came in is, the partners have commented they see big discrepancies between COs in the field and how they conduct business. How does USAID ensure consistency among missions in their procurement processes, and how can the partner community best raise issues to USAID without protesting a specific procurement?
Yes, Matt, thank you. I'd like to share a couple of thoughts on this question. First, one of the great strengths of USAID is its decentralization. By being a decentralized agency, we allow for development decisions and program design to take place in the field where there is an understanding of what is happening on the ground. I believe that our contracting and agreement officers, as development professionals, need to have the ability and authority to make decisions based on what they are seeing in the field. Obviously, as a result, as a partner, you may notice that a CO or AO in Zambia operates differently than a CO or AO in Nepal. But just because there are discrepancies in how they operate, it does not necessarily mean that they are doing anything wrong. Secondly, along with giving people the ability to make decisions on the ground, we need to make sure that all of our staff have a solid acquisition assistance foundation to work from. This comes through training. At USAID, we have 244 contracting and agreement officers. We have about 600 ANA professionals around the world, as well as 3,322 contracting and agreement officer representatives. Since 2011, we've trained over 2,200 Since 2011, we've trained over 2,200 folks through 120 courses that we've put out there. And this is all done through the PDT training division that was established back in 2012. We required that all contracting and agreement officers receive 80 hours of continual learning every 2 years. Our contracting and agreement officer representatives are required to receive 40 hours of continual learning every 2 years. A few years ago, we stood up, as I mentioned just earlier, within MOAA, a professional development and training division. And the purpose of this division, this office basically, is to help ensure consistency and standardization in the procurement process. We offer a significant number of instructor-led acquisition assistance courses and workshops. The training is based on the agency policy and procedures in the ADS, as well as mandatory topical templates and guides. The training curricula for these courses augment the Office of Management and Budget, OFPP, mandated federal acquisition regulatory requirements for acquisition and OMB Unifor guidance for assistance. We also offer a number of brownback training sessions based on current needs. For example, with the end of the fiscal year approaching, last week we offered a refresher training on harmonizing statements of work, instructions, and evaluation criteria. We have more than 100 individuals from around the world participate. We are scheduling two additional training for staff by the end of this month to help ensure our acquisition assistance workforce are equipped, to ensure that they're equipped by the end of the year push. Finally, I'd like to mention the work of our evaluation division. Through our evaluation division, we do periodic reviews of every operating unit in the agency that has a contracting function. In these reviews, we look to ensure that awards are made properly, they're administered properly, and they're closed out properly. Excuse me. The evaluation division helps to ensure that not only do we have compliance with the agency requirements within each unit, but there is a standard of quality being met. If standards of quality are not being met, then we put in place an action plan to make necessary corrections. Finally, if partners would like to raise an issue that they're seeing in the field, please contact our ombudsman.
Thank you, Aman. I want to give you a break from answering questions for a second. I want to turn over to Mauricio just for a couple of questions. We received a couple of questions from small business folks, Mauricio. One of the questions is this. There's been a discussion on including overseas contracts as a part of the baseline used to rate agency performance against small business contracting goals. What's the timeline for this implementation at USAID, and will the small business goals and achievements at the mission level be available to the public?
Thank you, Matt, and thank you, Aman, for having me here. Sure, that's a great question. I'd say that the inclusion of overseas awards in USAID's baseline has been a topic of discussion for several years. In fiscal year 2013, a small business indicator for our local solutions objective 3 under USAID Forward was created to highlight missions' U.S.-based small business achievements. You say senior officials thought that the SBI, or the Small Business Indicator, would prepare the agency for anticipated changes in the goaling and scorecard process and enhance mission staff's knowledge of the federal acquisition and small business program process. So the impetus for this was the National Defense Authorization Act of fiscal year 2013, which basically expedited implementing the SBI target for the agency's missions. It really, the act basically said that certain things could not be excluded from the goaling process, and this includes overseas awards. So USAID implemented its tracking and monitoring process for overseas prime awards to U.S.-based small businesses in fiscal year 2014. At this point, it's very likely, I would say almost 100%, that SBA will be including the overseas awards in the agency's baseline beginning in fiscal year 2016. And just by just to give you a sense of our goal, our current goal for 2015 is 14%. That's the prime contract goal for small businesses, and the subcontracting goal is 19%. Once the overseas are included, we expect these to change, and we're undergoing the negotiation process currently with the Small Business Administration. Those current and past small business goals and achievements are on the Small Business Administration's website. You can look at sba.gov and find that data. The agency's current worldwide prime U.S.-based small business indicator goal is 10%. It is not currently posted on a public site. Historically, the SBA announced the federal government's small business achievement and posted individual agencies' achievements on its website. The new small business achievements, once the overseas are included, will be posted and announced similarly.
Thank you, Mauricio. And we will send out links just for folks that want to see where the Small Business Administration goals are, both for USAID and on the SBA website. We'll send that out in the document that we share sort of after the call. The question on the small business front, Mauricio. If a small business is awarded a set-aside IDIQ contract and subsequently graduates out of the small business category during the award ordering period, does it continue to be eligible to be considered for small business task orders issued under that IDIQ?
Sure. A small business which has outgrown its size status may continue to bid on task orders which are set aside for small businesses under an IDIQ, but the firm must continue to validate and or update all of its representations in the System for Award Management, SAM, annually. However, whether the firm is actually eligible depends on how the small business outgrew its size status. If the firm grew to be large because its revenues exceeded the size standard, it would still be eligible to bid on set-asides. However, if the firm was acquired by a large business, it would not be eligible for small business set-aside awards under the IDIQ.
Okay. Thank you for that. I want to turn back over to Aman. One of the questions that come in is related to cancellation of solicitations. The partner that sent this question said there appears to be an increased number of awards being canceled during the solicitation period when proposals are being prepared or after submission. Over the last 3 years, our members have invested large amounts of funds preparing proposals for projects that USAID subsequently decides to cancel. Does USAID keep track of the number and value of programs canceled during the solicitation? Is there awareness by USAID staff of both the high cost in terms of direct financial investment and opportunity cost by not working on something else that this imposes on implementing partners? And has there been any discussion within USAID about how to address this concern?
Excellent question. We can assure you that our staff is very much aware of the impact felt by the partners when a solicitation is canceled, and will do so only when the situation leaves us with no viable alternative. The reasons for canceling a solicitation are fact-specific, but generally involves two central themes, programmatic needs and competition and fairness. There are instances where programmatic needs change to such an extent that the best interests of the taxpayers clearly weigh in favor of canceling a solicitation. In other instances, our requirements of funding levels may have changed to such an extent that the field of prospective offerers may change as a result. In such an instance, FAR 15206 prescribes that the CO cancel the original solicitation and issue a new one regardless of the stage of the acquisition. Because the facts and circumstances leading up to a cancellation are fact-specific, we do not keep statistics on the occurrence. If you believe a solicitation has been canceled in error, you may direct your inquiry to the ombudsman.
So I think we're going to be sending a lot of folks to the ombudsman email address. All of our
Diane, you're going to be quite busy.
Directions folks.
As
yeah.
if you have not been busy. But.
Yeah, we have a great ombudsman who can help with answer a lot of your questions. another question that seems to be, I would say, a frequently asked question of us is how partners can be engaged in the policymaking process at USAID.
Okay, Matt. Thanks. If partners have comments that would like to share on specific USAID internal policies, which are published in the ADS chapters, they could communicate with the ANA ombudsman. How many? Wow, that's okay. When relevant policies are being revised, those comments will be taken into consideration. But I think it's important to note that most of our policies are requirements that come from outside the agency. USAID can be required to issue policy provisions and clauses based on a statute from Congress, either from a new law or as part of our annual appropriation authorization, an executive order issued by the president, or a requirement to implement a policy issued by the Office of Management and Budget. USAID has very little ability to change or exempt these requirements, which often include specific language that must be implemented as stated in our awards. If partners would like to provide feedback on policies coming down the pike, I would encourage our partners to go directly to the source or where their policy is being developed.
Thank you, Mana. I just want to kind of follow up to that. I think, you know, one of the things that I think we talked about internally is folks are sending questions, I have questions about policy being drafted, that the comments and feedback that you guys do send in throughout the year, we do take that into consideration as we're looking at new agency policies. So it may be something you sent to us 6 months ago about assistance, you know, as we're looking at making updates,
right.
You know, we take all of those comments into consideration, even if we aren't necessarily always, you know, directly saying that. So I just want to be clear on that. Next question for you, Mon, is on fiscal year 2016 and guidance. Many believe that Congress will not pass a regular appropriation for USAID before the start of the next fiscal year. What plans does USAID have in place to inform its implementing partners regarding performance on projects into that next fiscal year? And how can they expect to be paid? Last year, under similar circumstances, guidance was provided with 3 days before the start of the new fiscal year. Having the information in advance would greatly improve the agency and partners' ability to maintain continuity of development assistance delivery. Do you have any comment on that or thoughts on that?
Sure. A potential lapse in funding is a concern of partners and the agency alike. At this time, we do not know whether a lapse in funding will actually occur. We are still 2 months away from the beginning of the new fiscal year, and we do not have any definitive information about which way things are going to go. Essentially, we have no news or guidance at this time. It is best not to speculate. Instead, we're continuing with ongoing acquisition and assistance activities. That's all I have for that, Matt.
Yeah, thank you, Aman. Moving on to question 12 of our 16 questions. There's a number of different ANA documents that partners feel that are essential to them. They could include things like procurement executive bulletins, mission ANA notices, standard operating procedures that we put out, SOAGs, a number of different documents. Partners have commented they're often difficult to obtain. Would you allow partners to submit a list of documents that we could post on USAID's website? If not, do we have a methodology or way of publicly informing the partner community when changes are made to standard provisions or to the ADS?
I understand that it is often difficult to access information published by USAID. I would certainly be open to you sending us ideas on the type of information we can provide to you. If you have input, please send it to us at ombudsman@usaid.gov. Some of the documents mentioned in the question are for internal audiences only. We will need to look at your request on a case-by-case basis to determine which specific documents can be released to the public. Internally, we've been discussing how we can revamp the information that is available on USAID.gov for partners and potential partners on how to work with USAID. One of the things that is currently missing in a section on the site called Partner Resources. And that's, Matt, I think what you mentioned that you'd be working on.
Yeah, so I think if you look at our website, I think they have information for partners available, but it's not really organized very well.
Yeah.
So really trying to create a new section on the website that's specifically called Partner Resources or something along those lines where there's sort of a one-stop shop for partners to access information that we're posting.
There is some information, as you mentioned, Matt, available on our website, but it's really, it is difficult to find. And again, if you have suggestions or thoughts on what we can add to this partner resources section or to the work with USAID section as a whole, please let us know. I would also like to mention the implementing partners network portals or IPN portals. Last year, we launched two IPN portals, one for assistance and one for acquisition. The IPN portals are used to disseminate and share information that is relevant and important to all of our partners. For example, a few months ago, we were receiving a number of questions about the open data policy. We shared an open data fact document through the portals. Finally, we created an email distribution list to share announcements and updates about the business forecast. Since we launched, we've had more than 1,400 people sign up for it. We have been discussing internally how we can better utilize this list for sharing additional information and resources with our partners. We have given a lot of thought as to how we can better communicate and share information with you. My hope is that through calls like this one and the tools we've put in place, that getting access to information will become much easier.
Thank you, Aman. I want to turn over to Bruce McFarland, who is the Chief of Operational Innovations with our lab. We regularly see questions about how the lab is operating, in particular broad agency announcements. So I want to share a comment that one of the partners sent to us and then ask a few questions around it, if you permit me to read this partner's comment. So partners have commented that the lab's approach of inviting expressions of interest to participate in targeted collaboration idea generation, inviting a selective group of applicants to participate in a joint creation workshop is innovative and draws on practices in private industry. However, in their experience, expecting this selected applicants to form impromptu collaborations and produce ideas that may or may not be pursued imposes heavy costs on partners. They believe that this is especially hard on small and non-U.S. partners who invest a great deal to participate, then have very little real prospect of an actual award that would justify their investment of scarce resources. In a way, they believe that USAID is extracting the value from the participants by mining them for ideas without covering any of their costs. Partners have also seen cases where USAID and staff, a select group, to submit joint proposals for relatively small awards that couldn't possibly support all of the organizations that participate in the idea generation. So with that statement comment, Bruce, can you explain a little bit more about the goal and purpose of a broad agency announcement? And could you also kind of respond to this thought about or comment about BAAs?
Yeah, Matt. Basically, the way we are using BAAs recently out of the Global Development Lab and out of the rest of the agency has caused a lot of questions, and so it's kind of an interesting area. I want to be really clear about this. What we really use a BAA for is for collaboration. When the development problem is not well understood and there appears to be an opportunity for innovation. So it's not a method of doing seeking out requirements that we already understand. It's used to do collaboration. It's fundamentally a research and development technique. In comparison to the traditional competitive proposal process, participants actually spend very little to submit a 5-page statement of interest and significantly less than a full proposal. They spend significantly less than a full proposal, especially considering the background analyses and research required. So participating in a BAA, to our experience so far, has not been as costly as submitting full proposals. It should be noted that small and non-U.S. partners have a significant investment to It should be noted that small and non-U.S. partners have significant investment to compete in our traditional processes. Typically, we receive a large number of responses to every solicitation, and typically only one receives funding. So again, it's a little incorrect to perceive this as a high risk for funding sort of engagement under a BAA, when in reality our traditional competitive processes also engender a lot of risk for a offer that their proposal will not be accepted. We understand that participants cannot linger in the process, and we feel this pressure is healthy and keeps the process moving swiftly. This happens as people participate in the BAA. They remind us that we cannot linger on this, and usually the nature of a BAA with a collaboration effort, everyone is focused on the problem, so they do tend to move along very quickly. In addition, because this is a forum for collaboration, our experience has been that partners often discover other opportunities and resources beyond just USAID funding. We don't really receive the concern from partners in the process that there's a high risk a low value to participating in the process. We would like to hear more specific details if you have them. If you participate in the process and you have details, then we would like to hear about how this process does cost you as a participant more than a traditional proposal process. It's an interesting question about mining ideas without compensation. I haven't run into that issue so far on any of the feedback I've gotten from our actual collaborations once the participants understand the collaborative approach. When we seek statements of interest, sometimes we will seek your ideas under statement of interest, but your ideas really are a method for us to evaluate your creativity that you bring to the problem. When you walk in the door on a BAA, it's not to sell your idea. BAA is not a method to do unsolicited proposals. It's a method to do collaboration. And so it's not about your idea. It's about the grand idea that comes together as people participate thinking about a development area of interest. I'd also like to point out that when we do a traditional procurement, we get lots of ideas as well. The vast majority of those ideas are not successful for a variety of reasons and are not selected for funding. So again, I'm not really clear the issue about mining for ideas when in reality with a regular competitive proposal process, you're also submitting your ideas to us as well. One of the reasons why and I'll talk about this in a second here, I've got this in the wrong order, but one of the reasons why I'm sure you don't present most radical ideas under initial proposals is because there's a lot of risks that we will misunderstand in the regular competitive proposal process, that we'll misunderstand your idea or we'll see aspects of that idea that you can't really have a good conversation about. And so, again, the BAA provides a much better environment for us to be able to collaborate on innovative ideas. So, as a result of that, in my experience, over the last 25 years of contracting or so, we rarely get a truly radical or innovative approach surfacing through our traditional competitions. That's not to say that you all haven't been participating in a lot of innovations. In fact, our E3 Bureau recently did an audit and found, using a very restricted definition of innovation, and found about 48% of instruments had actually done innovations during implementations that were significant. The thing is that when you present an innovation, it's usually during the implementation. It's not usually as a matter of getting the award. And again, for the reasons that I stated before, innovations really take a lot of collaboration to work out. Famously, there is the alternative proposal clause that we use in every one of our solicitations, where you can propose an innovative alternative to a requirement that we've put out. That, to the best of my knowledge, is never used. I've never received one, although it's there for people to use. But again, I think you're reluctant to use those because of the risks involved with alternative proposals. So again, let me say the BAA provides a great forum for collaboration, especially in the cases where the problem is not well understood and the solution set is not clear. We don't use BAAs for traditional competitive approaches as a substitute. We don't use it as a substitute for traditional approaches. The research areas of interest in BAAs don't lend themselves to a tidy statement of work or program description. So it happens that we've seen this process address a lot of unmet needs in the agency, where previously we either took no action or settled for a poor performing description of our requirements. I'd like to point out that many times that we have done, and I know this frustrates you, we've done statements of work or PDs that you look at and you can't quite understand because we're trying to address something that is confusing. Again, by moving away when we don't have a clear understanding of the development problem or the development solution set, by moving away to a collaborative environment, I think provides everybody with a much clearer opportunity to innovate.
Thank you, Bruce. I think I want to drill down a little bit more specific, and I think you kind of talked a little bit about this, but you know, has there been any examination of whether using a BA is truly a viable approach for public procurement?
The broad agency announcement is not a new mechanism. It's in, it's authorized by FAR 35.016. It's been by used for years by other agencies. In our experience so far, this is a great way to engage both traditional and non-traditional partners and create much richer, deeper solutions to complex development problems. We've particularly had success working closer with small and local organizations, especially those that are unfamiliar with USAID processes, because again, the collaborative environment allows us an opportunity to really engage closely with what the issues are. We believe that the co-creation process ultimately leads to better targeted programs and to meet development objectives. And while traditional solicitation or proposal approaches work well, in fact, they work very well, when the requirements and the objectives are well understood, collaboration is a much better approach when the pathway to a solution is not clear. We believe that the BAA process will be less a frustrating process for applicants and proposers, especially in these cases. BAA is also used to attract resource partners as well. So the total opportunities could actually increase substantially. In fact, a lot of our BAAs now are attracting people who provide resourcing or we collaborate with folks that provide other opportunities as well to align opportunities with USAID and actually with the collaborative effort. Another one of those things that's difficult to get around if you're used to the traditional process is collaboration means it's not a USAID solution. It's a collaborative solution from the people around the table co-creating and co-developing under the BAA. Our external resourcing relationships generally are difficult and lengthy to craft in a traditional competitive environment, And so again, this creates a great way to collaborate with other folks who also are bringing money to the table to solve development problems. For instance, one of our, I do want to give an example of a BAA that tells you a little bit about what ends up resulting. When we did the next generation Ebola suit, I think you're familiar with the Ebola crisis. What we ended up with is people working in a hot environment in rubber suits, very difficult to engage with patients. And so we went out through a BAA and came with a collaboration. One of the really cool ideas came from a collaboration between us and university students and a wedding dress maker that ended up with a completely redefined idea of how that Ebola suit would work. So, you know, who would have thought? The idea of creation of new ideas and innovations generally come best when we can talk about them in a clear and transparent manner. And so that's what the BAA provides us with the opportunity to do.
Thank you, Bruce. Just one final question, and this is, once again, something you've kind of hit on before, but I just want to ask it very specifically. Has USAID examined whether the BAA approach creates unrealistic expectations on the part of groups with less experience working with USAID?
Well, actually, what we've discovered is that the unrealistic expectations generally that we have to deal with first are from organizations that have done business with USAID or the federal government in the past, because they keep trying to fit this into a traditional competitive environment, and it's not. It does qualify as a competitive approach, but the competition is about the merit of the idea, that single brilliant idea going before a science peer review board and demonstrating its merit. We can usually get to the issues very quickly when people first come together and they're invited together to work under a BAA to be able to deal with the expectations of people who come to the table. And the nice thing about the BAA environment is entirely transparent. And so it's easy to have these sort of conversations after we've accepted your statement of interest and we've all gathered together. The point of the BAA, though, is that we can have these conversations and discuss these issues in detail, fully and transparently. So if you do have concerns about the speed of the process, if you do have concerns about the risks that you're having in the process, we can discuss these things very openly. Participants don't have to hide your concerns or play coy for fear of losing a competition. This is a competition, like I said, about the merit of a single brilliant idea. And it could be several ideas, I understand that. But the idea is that it's an idea as it stands by itself, not being compared with other ideas, not being compared with a statement of work or a set of evaluation criteria in that sense. And this is an idea about that is formulated by the co-creation team collaboratively. It is not a head-to-head competition with other participants around the table. So in summary, the BAA process so far, we've received only positive feedback. In fact, we've received some very positive feedback because people get to participate with us in the rest of our internal workings as well about how we program funding and how we figure out how to authorize things and how we craft relationships and things of that nature. But that being said, this is a new process for USAID, and we'd certainly welcome additional feedback and concrete examples about how we can make the process better. You know, and I laugh here, but please send your comments to the Ombudsman. Or you can also send them to me as well. But your specific issues in this process, as you experience the process, are of great concern to us. Thank you very much.
Matt, just to follow up on what Bruce was saying regarding contacting the Ombudsman, I was just following up on the Twitter right now. And there's some comments there saying that the Ombudsman's getting stuck answering a lot of these questions. That's not the intention. The intention is to have one point of contact for all information to go to the Ombudsman, and then the Ombudsman will farm it out and then will get back to you. So please understand that the Ombudsman is one person, but actually she has a whole team that she works with to try to answer and get the right answers to you all. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Aman.
Yeah.
And I want to follow up just one thing, Bruce. I know we talked a little bit about this couple days ago.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of folks, probably one of our traditional partners, the BAA process is very, very different from how they've ever worked with USAID before. And I think one of the things we talked about is maybe hosting a couple of mock BAA process seminars to actually walk people through the process to understand of how it all works. Is that?
Yeah. You know, actually, we did have this conversation, Matt, and Matt is the one who came up with this idea, and I think it's a brilliant idea where we could just simply walk people through a process in about 1 hour or so. I can explain to people, you know, actually mock process, so actually pseudo participating in it, and I can walk people through what normally happens. There's a lot of human factors that happen, people positioning themselves and stuff like that we observe. So I think it would be very valuable. Folks, I think, would get more comfortable with it if they could see that. So we're planning on doing that perhaps the first quarter of FY16 after the end of fiscal year crunch.
Thank you. So we've got three more questions. I know we're going over time, but we're going to stick through and go through these last three questions that we've got. So understand if folks need to hop off and go something else. Next question, I want to turn back to Aman for the last couple of questions. This question came in from one of the partner associations. Can you clarify USAID's practice of combining summary information on grants.gov with the full text of funding opportunities versus the display of summary and information in advance, and USAID's determination to limit funding opportunities to 30 calendar days?
Okay, Matt, thank you. First, 2 CFR 200.203 states that summary information must precede the full text of the announcement. We interpret this to mean that the summary information must appear in the first part of the NOFO and the full text must appear in a subsequent section. We do not interpret 203A as requiring that the summary be posted at an earlier time than the full text of the NOFO. Sorry, this is a little bit confusing, but we'll get it right. So basically, there's been no agency-wide determination to limit funding opportunities to 30 days, right? ADS 303 was revised on July 22nd to reflect the recommendations in 2 CFR 200.203 to make all RFAs available for receipt of applications for at least 60 calendar days. To the greatest extent practicable and consistent with 2 CFR 200.203, AOs must determine an application deadline that provides sufficient time for applicants to adequately respond to the complexity of the requirements of the NOFO while balancing other considerations such as political, agriculture, climatic events, et cetera, that may affect the timing needs for receipt of applications. For receipt of applications less than 30 days from the release of the NOFO, AOs must provide a written determination for the file. It was a substantial effort to make ADS 303 policy consistent with CFR. This is an ongoing effort, and we will continue to revise ADS to make it consistent with OMB's policy.
Thank you, Aman. The last two questions I want to go to, I think one of everyone's favorite topic to talk about is the business forecast. This partner commented that they know that USAID has made a lot of improvements on the business forecast as of late, but there still seems to be some issues getting information up to date. Can you clarify sort of what are the next steps for USAID updating the business forecast and getting it to improving it even more?
Thanks, Pat. In answering this question, I think it's important that folks recognize that the business forecast that we publish is a quarterly snapshot in time. This means that when we pull the forecast and publish it, information will change and dates will move as the quarter progresses. What you see online is not updated on a real-time basis. However, we do allow for missions to make updates to the forecast as needed throughout the quarter. I think we have taken many big strides ensuring that the business forecast, when published, is accurate. Last quarter, when we realized that the forecast that was initially published was not accurate, we notified the partner community and took action to correct it immediately. As far as next steps to improve the forecast, as many of you know, last year we rolled out a new acquisition assistance planning tool that is used to track all upcoming actions and is used to pull snapshots of the business forecast document posted online. We are still working with several missions to get them to fully adopt the ANA planning tool. Where we have seen missions fully adopt the system, we find very accurate and timely information published on the forecast. We still see some challenges in producing the forecast where missions haven't fully adopted the system. So with regards to the last part of this question, I think the next steps for us include coordinating additional training for mission on how to effectively use the ANA tool. Secondly, getting more senior leadership support of the new ANA planning tool. In Washington, we have provided several assistant administrators with access to the ANA planning tool. And as a result, we have seen a drastic improvement in the information pulled from the business forecast by these bureaus. We need to get similar buy-in from mission directors. I have already begun doing outreach to them. Last month, I met with more than 25 mission directors and spoke with them about the ANA planning tool and the business forecast. Next week, I will speak with 30 additional mission directors. I think we have a great new tool and a process in place to capture information for the business forecast. We just need to get everyone to utilize the ANA tool to its full potential.
Thank you, Aman. The last question, I would throw this up as one of the other frequently asked questions that I think we've seen asked on the business forecast, the last two quarterly phone calls that have come in, as well as the question that we see asked on a regular basis. Partners noticed that requests for task order proposals under IDIQs are not included on the business forecast. What's USAID's thinking in regards to putting advance notice of them on the business forecast, or why haven't we done that?
Yes, Matt, you're exactly right. This question has been brought up by the partner community many times. During our last two business forecast calls and private meetings partners, we've been asked to include the request for task order proposals on the business forecast. Historically, as you mentioned, we have not included them because we want the forecast to only include information that is fully open to competition. We thought that including task orders would create confusion among the partners community. However, I understand that often task orders come out unexpectedly, leaving partners scrambling to put together proposals. There have been also occasions where information included on the forecast has switched over to a task order and subsequently removed from the forecast altogether. I want you to know that we've heard you. In the interest of addressing your business concerns and maximizing transparency, we plan to pilot the reporting of RFTOPs under IDIQs on the first business forecast of FY 2016, expected in late October or early November. This will be a pilot. We're going to try it. But, please be aware that if the margin for reporting error turns out to be too high, then we may have to revisit putting them on the business forecast.
Yeah. Thank you, Aman. So that wraps up our first Ask the Procurement Executive phone call. We appreciate everyone calling in. We appreciate all the questions. Thank you for the association for collecting all the questions. Like I mentioned, we have recorded this phone call, and we will be sending out a recording as well as a summary document with the responses to all of these questions. So once again, I just want to say thank you for participating, and we look forward to doing with you next quarter. Thank you.